Well, welcome to all of you. I didn't know whether we were going to have 5 people or 500 people. I think we have exactly the right number for the intimate conversation that we promised. It's wonderful to have someone who is a truly important political actor and political thinker from India. Who can really, there are very few people who can give you both the kind of intellectual power that befits you being here at Harvard, and is also an insider. And we have that in Arun Shuri. I want to thank Jayant Sinha, my former mentor at McKinsey, who is organizing the Boston part of Mr. Shuri's trip. Son Rishabh for coordinating, South Asian Men's Collective, the Kennedy School for hosting us, and a special virtual greeting to, on the computer and recorder, to our listeners at livemint.com, which is the website of the very fine Mint newspaper in India, which is a partnership with the Wall Street Journal. It's publishing a podcast of this talk. And that's because I was pestered immediately as soon as I publicized this talk by readers and journalists in India who were very desperate to know what Mr. Shuri was going to say today. So I have to give you a warning, sir. We have a rule here in America that whatever happens in Las Vegas stays in Las Vegas, but what happens at Harvard surely does not. So whatever you say here is going to follow you wherever you go. Arun Shuri is one of those rare creatures who gets to live many lives in just one life. He worked for the World Bank in the early part of his career in its Young Professionals program. He went on to be a renowned journalist and editor in India, the Indian Express and the Times of India, becoming one of the most aggressive, feared, and admired thorns in the side of power in India. Producing the kind of gritty investigative journalism that, frankly, one sees sadly too little of in India today. Then he found a new life in politics in the rightist Hindu nationalist BJP party, where he served, among other things, as disinvestment minister, disinvestment being the euphemistic Indian term for privatization, which is, of course, an important part of what transition economies do. He was a very popular minister with the business community in particular. Now, of course, the BJP's time in power has ended, and with 2 successive victories for the Congress Party, center-left Congress Party, in 2004 and 2009. But Mr. Shuri, again, has gone back to one of his other lives, resuming his work as a regular book writer and columnist. He just told me he's done 25 books, which is a lot of books. And has remained one of the most influential voices in the kind of argumentative Indian conversation. We're particularly fortunate to have him here today because in the last few weeks and months, he's managed to get himself into a bit of trouble with his candor. After the BJP's second consecutive defeat in the federal elections, this time in May of this year, Mr. Shuri has joined a handful of senior leaders in the party in the normally quiet, restrained party discussions. He's joined a senior handful of people who have publicly questioned, in some ways, what he might not, but others would call the rigidity of the party and its failure to adapt to new realities that might make it more successful. And ever the phraseologist, he referred to a colleague of his recently as Alice in Blunderland. So, very warm welcome to you, sir. And I thought I might begin by asking you, since some of us here may be very up to date on Indian politics and many perhaps less so, perhaps bring us up to date on the soul searching that this last electoral defeat has produced and how, in the midst of that soul searching, you managed to get yourself into a bit of trouble.
The only reason for that question must be to get me into further trouble.
See, he's a journalist and a politician.
You see, it is commonplace in India for many persons to say that the the dissonance which has become apparent in the BJP is the result of defeat. Now you don't have the loaves and fishes of office, and therefore people are fighting each other. But actually, it is the other way around. The defeat was the result of the condition of the party, which has become apparent since the defeat, more than occasions. And as far as the soul searching is concerned, there is never a good time within hierarchical or disciplined organizations to look inside. Because if you are winning, if you have won, where is the need for any introspection? If you lose, you said you lose a second consecutive time, then we are already in such desperate circumstances and you want further trouble and blame game, as it is said. Nobody is pasting any blame on anyone. The idea really is that, yes, we should be current, that organizationally we should be a lean and fit organization. We should not just be an electoral machine. The conduct of individuals must be exemplary. Who can say that these things are not necessary? And who can say that in any one of our political parties today, all these things are already assured? So some of us had given examples of what we need, what needs to be done. I would presume that there is more looking within in the parent organization of the BJP, that is the RSS, rather than in the BJP, as yet. The reason for that is that all political parties, including the BJP, have become parties of 3-4 persons at every level, for the projection of 3-4 persons. And decisions at every level depend on those 3-4 persons. You look at any political party in India, it is this way. The result is that when persons who are not one among those 3 or 4 ask for something to be inquired into, who is to inquire? Who is to decide that there should be a soul searching? It is those 3-4 persons. So they are averse to doing it because they suddenly feel that their way of running is the one that is being questioned, as in a family enterprise.
If I can pin you down on some of the specific criticisms that have been made by you, by Mr. Kulkarni and others. Criticism number one, the party has failed to win the confidence of 150 million Muslims in India. Fair criticism, unfair criticism?
I would not strain too hard on that. I think the BJP should stand for a true secularism, which I would include as this, that the individual should be the unit of state policy, not a group, not Muslims, not Hindus, not caste. Second, that in identifying that individual, the criteria must be secular criteria. Income, assets, education of parents, whichever way you feel deprivation can be defined that way. Third, that we should never give to the organization of any religion what we will not give to the organizations of other religions or persons speaking in the name of other religions. And fourth, we should never give to an organization speaking in the name of a religion what we would deny to an organization which is just a secular organization. And I can give you many instances in which on each of these criteria, Indian polity is not secular.
And let's take religion and let's take caste.
Caste, for instance, reservations are on the basis of caste.
Now, which is affirmative action for
affirmative action is too good a name. It is just blocking of
set aside
seats. Yes, set aside of seats in admissions of jobs now in promotions. And you do not know, probably, the absurd levels to which this is done. It's not just done by four castes. It is done by sub-castes of sub-castes of sub-castes. And by a thing called a roster system, some post will be reserved for the sub-sub-sub-caste. Only that person can be promoted. And sometimes you don't find a person for that post. And I have documented cases in which persons were promoted two levels in government service on one day, because for the next post also there was nobody else. Persons getting 1.5% marks in the total entrance exam got seats in medical colleges, when others getting 70% didn't get them. I have a book called Falling Over Backwards, in which many of these cases are documented. So that is because you're identifying by group. And it is said that it is a backward caste. But actually, it's not a backward caste. Rajputs who dominate Rajasthan, Jats who are very strong in Haryana, in Punjab, in Western UP, they have all rested. You know, it's not that I am a backward caste and the state at last identifies me. It is that the caste has become strong enough that it can wrest the title of backwardness from the state. There are two castes that dominate the politics in Karnataka, a state in southern India, Vokaligas and Lingayas. And successive commissions have said that they are not backward. But the moment any government has tried to implement that decision, riots have broken out and the effort has been given up. Similarly, in religion, who could have thought? I am sure absolutely nobody, not your supervisor, Professor Amartya Sen, or anyone, could have thought that under Dr. Manmohan Singh as a Prime Minister, from the Prime Minister's office, an instruction would go out to banks, nationalized banks, that they must keep separate account of the loans that have been given to on the basis of religion. Who could have thought? Is this secular? Or that allocations shall be made to districts on the basis of the proportion of non-Hindu population in those states. It's not secular. So, if saying all, I would think that the BJP should stand for true secularism. And if in saying all this, Muslims are alienated or castes are alienated, well, they are alienated. But because in the long run, this is the position which will be vindicated. Otherwise, as you have seen, because of caste-based reservations, our society has been splintered. Caste was being erased by modernization. It was being dissolved.
So let me see if I can just clarify that last point you made. If the party going forward, you have some criticisms, but if the party going forward does what you think are the right things in principle and never gets another Muslim vote, you don't have a problem with that?
Well, I'm not into electoral politics. But yes, I would not have a problem with that, because in the end, Muslims themselves would see this is the way for their advancement and their protection. After all, for 60 years, governments have been saying, oh, we are working for Muslims. Who has said this more than the communists in West Bengal? And if you see the statistics so-called gathered by the Satchar Committee, a committee formed by this government, on every count, the Muslims in West Bengal are worse off than in any other state on any count. Is that the way to deal with the Muslims? So I would think that supposing a Muslim family or a Hindu family or caste, upper or lower caste family, is destitute, how does it matter what their religion or caste is? You identify them that way. And it is not difficult to identify. After all, in all our subsidies, these food subsidy programs, other assistance, we have a category called below poverty line families. They are identified by income, by assets. No problem. Nobody says it's unfair.
I want to push back on that for a moment, because you know, one of the things that when I was working as a correspondent in India, one of the things that really came alive for me were some of the arguments that are made in this country about affirmative action for African Americans and other minority groups. And one of the most persuasive arguments made by proponents in this country is that it is not just economic exclusion. So you can't just look at who's poor or who's disadvantaged, because there are cultural, social, and psychological legacies of pervasive discrimination that are deeper than simply being poor. And I'll give you one example from India that always struck me. It was by Carla Hoff, who's a World Bank economist, very respected economist. And they played a game with 500 students in an Indian village. And first, they divided them into two camps, actually by caste, but they didn't inform people. Well, they didn't divide them by caste. They just knew who everyone's caste was. And they played the game, and they collected the scores. It was a maze. The second time around, they announced, they split these people here by caste, and they played the same game. And the lower caste students' scores went down by 26%, simply by having their caste said in public in front of other people. Right? Their income didn't change, their economic status didn't change. You're talking about a millennia-old system of inequity. Is just sticking to principles of equality enough to redress that kind of pervasive...
No, but what
treatment?
Do you infer from that very test? Don't announce castes. Do not have criteria by which you again put a label of a caste on some person. You are taking the opposite inference. In an overcrowded bus, you know, if you read Dumont's book on this Homo Hierarchicus, he says, if the shadow of an untouchable falls on a South Indian Brahmin, the fellow has to bathe six times. Whose hands he will eat from, whose hands he will take water from are all prescribed. In an overcrowded bus or railway compartment, does anybody find out who is pushing him? But supposing you said, no, the poor fellow can't get onto the bus, therefore I'm going to have separate buses for the higher and lower caste. You will then be branding and picking the opposite, inferring the wrong lesson from this, what you call very famous, well-regarded economist of the World Bank, her survey. And that is what has happened. You see, all casual observation would have shown, and we would have expected, that people fight today, this business of rules from whose water you will, whose hand you will take water. People fight for municipal water. Do they first find out who's working in the municipal water works? I feel that by power, discourse, politics, everything congeals around the criteria of state policy and state programs. So if you use criteria which reinforce this millennia of categorization, then you are worsening things, not improving them.
But just to again be clear, when we talk about slavery in this country, we're talking about something measured in centuries. You're talking about caste in India, you're talking about something measured in millennia. You're confident that completely neutral policies will deliver the kind of caste justice that India requires. Being completely caste blind.
That's a very interesting point. You say about millennia, and these are cliches that are internalized. I'll give you an instance. In this book of mine called Falling Over Backwards, the first 100 pages are actually from the notings of British officers till the 1930s of the census commissioners. District census commissioners, provincial census commissioners, the central census commissioner. Now, in that, there's a very interesting observation that caste in India is fluid. It is water, he says. Because the whole argument since the 1911 census till 1931, which was the last census when caste was enumerated, the argument of the British officers was, we should not have this enumeration. It is, this is their phrase, a meaningless classification, a meaningless enumeration. And they gave the example that, look here, if you have a caste in a particular district, last time was 800,000 people in the last census. This time it has come down to 100,000. What has happened? It turned out that they had all been elevated and recognized to be in a higher caste. So the census commissioner said that they are always appealing to us to recognize, anoint them to be parts of a higher caste. And the chief census commissioner said, that's a very good idea. We should be the College of Heralds, anointing people in higher caste, because this is the fine aspiration. Now, what has happened? Because of caste-based reservations, caste-based allocations, caste-based rhetoric of the left parties included, who wanted to play caste politics but could not do it because of their ideological rhetoric, they started saying, no, but in India, class is caste. Caste is class. So what has happened as a result? Now the competition is to be recognized as a low, depressed class. So where is this millennia business? You read the files of the 1930s. I know that you as a person go through these documents. It's a wonderful thing to see. They are erudite people. They are observing. They are sitting in faraway places. Communication is not very good in those days. They are giving you true picture of what's the situation on the ground. But we keep saying it's millennia, millennia. And as far as this that observation about those two, dividing people into two, there are many studies done in this country in which on no criteria at all a class of infants is divided into two. They are them, we are us. And how they start ranking each other just by this business of the other, on no basis at all. So my plea is to reverse this, and a great responsibility lies on all of us who keep regurgitating the leftist cliches that have been internalized in Indian public discourse.
Let me turn, since I seem to have, I just want to focus on the original question of criticisms before we move on. I didn't pick the right ones, evidently, but what are the most important, legitimate, and serious criticisms of the BJP as it's presently constituted that could be made?
Well, I would naturally want to put it more positively so that I don't get into trouble about enlisting criticisms. And I think we have to find a way of relating advancement within the party to performance. This is one. This is what Mr. Jaswant Singh, Yashwant Sinha, and others are quite right to say. And there's a widespread feeling in the party on that. And I am sure that is how things will come about in the future. One of the ways to do this is to actually have cross-verification of what the senior leadership hears about the work of individuals. Because now, what is happening in all political parties, not just the BJP, is that everybody has a telephone sort of connection with some other person in a state unit and then to a local unit. And from that, information or rumor or suggestion flows upwards of good work or of loyalty, and that is how advancement occurs.
But it's not an objective performance
culture. Yes, therefore one should do the opposite. That is, that when you get information, there must be other ways of finding out, including retired intelligence officials who might have worked in that area and whom you have trust in, who are ideologically predisposed towards the party, or whatever other ways. Or there are journalists, maybe civil servants can tell you about more prominent people in an area. I always find that as a very good cross-check to what I hear. For instance, if there is a corrupt practice in a particular state government, almost the best informants will be journalists who have worked with you personally or civil servants, because they know what is really happening.
Okay, so let's say performance culture. What else?
I would think a greater clarity on economic issues. because it's not really very clear. When the under Mr. Bajpayee, I found that in certain some of the persons were really the true suddenly became great Nehruites in terms of socialist seeing virtues in socialist policies. So probably greater clarity on economic matters. Mm-hmm. I would think for all political parties, including the BJP, a greater, more reflection, deeper study of particular issues. You know, everything is becoming now one-liners on for television. That's not right. After all, if one has to think about China or about the real nature of Pakistan, it's not for the evening news. It requires deep study and deeper reflection so that you can come to a particular view. You can't just say, bomb Pakistan, bomb Tibet, bomb this. So one must reflect deeply on these issues of great importance. Third, I would think that we should stop reacting to what governments are doing. It's not enough now to do that. It's not enough to do the traditional political thing, and that is to go on so-called articulating the people's problems. The people know those problems. They are living those problems. We have to convince them that if we were in office, we would have a better chance of alleviating those problems for you. So competence must be visible on all matters, that we have better ideas and we have a better record of implementing those better ideas. So I would think many such things that...
Is it a fair inference or one that you don't share the view that the idea of a more inclusive party at least belongs at that very high list of priorities?
Yes, but very high, right? And the inclusive party would be based on true secular principles, not on appeasing Muslims or appeasing lower castes or higher castes or anybody. No. A truly secular ideology would be a completely inclusive party. Why not champion that? You see, there are two ways of looking at these things. One is, look at sections. Frighten a section. Bamboozle a section with promises. Then present yourself as the only available savior for that section. That has been the traditional Congress approach. And that then culminated in or descended into clearly regional, clearly linguistic, and now clearly caste parties. So we should do the opposite of having a pan-Indian ideology, pan-Indian appeal, and I feel that the best way is, as I mentioned to you, just as, for example, those three, four principles, I could elaborate on them, but they are evident. They would not exclude anybody.
Let me, I think we've catered a bit to those who might know a little bit more to begin with, talking about the current situation. Let's step back a bit for those who may be less familiar with Indian politics. You hear your party's associated with various phrases with the word Hindu in it, from Hindutva to Hindu nationalist to Hindu fundamentalist to Hindu extremist, all kinds of labels. Explain to us what is the relationship between what does Hindutva mean? Not in terms of what you've already told us in terms of a secular government, but specifically in terms of the Hindu religion.
I wouldn't know. So those persons, that question should best be addressed to the persons who use that word.
Do you think
And also to the persons who use the characterization of Hindu nationalist, which is what you used in the beginning, or Hindu fundamentalist, which you just now used. As to what do you understand by that, I don't know.
Do you think Hindutva is not relevant to the BJP going forward?
As a word, everybody keeps using this word, but I've asked in print also as to what does it really mean. Then people say, oh, look at the Supreme Court judgment. It says it is a way of life. But Islam is a way of life. Atheism is a way of life.
So is there anything specially Hindu about the BJP?
I think it has taken up issues on the rebound to correct the appeasement of in the name of Muslims, not of Muslims, but in the name of Muslims, to the controllers of Muslim vote banks. Therefore, for instance, when the Shah Bano case came up, when the state was seen to be bending to a terrorist group like Bhindranwale's group in Punjab, so that the weak state bending to overtly religious pressures, or to the pressures of persons speaking in the name of religion, whether the advocates of reform in Muslim, whether the opponents of reform in Muslim personal law, or Bhindranwale, who had been put up by the Congress Party, then an issue like Ayodhya got great resonance in India. So it took up some issues of this kind which could be associated with Hindu cultural and religious tradition. And that is what it means. But I would feel that those are not the primary ways even of convincing the electorate as an electorate today. The primary ways are to deliver on governance.
Who is most responsible for, because I think you would agree that what you have just said is not necessarily the view over the past several years by people with influence within the party. Who is most responsible for pushing it in a direction other than what you just described?
I think the persons outside the BJP who started using these characterizations and the drift of state policy towards appeasing groups. They then were countered by the BJP, which then started speaking in the Hindu so-called idiom. In the personal lives of the leaders of the RSS, several of the Hindu values, not very distinct from Buddhist values, were evident in their personal lives, as they were evident in Gandhiji's life. Austerity, for instance, a pride in and a deep conviction that, yes, we have our tradition, our religion, our inner quest, this emphasis on the inner quest has something to contribute to the world. These things are not today evident in the leaders of any political party. So, but in a preceding generation, these were more evident in the BJP, in the Jan Sangh and the RSS leadership. And before that, in many of the Congress leaders, Gandhiji and all the other nationalists, Sri Aurobindo, Raman Maharishi, all of them together.
I want to ask you a question that was something that I wrote about when I was still in India and concerned. Many people, not just journalists and foreign correspondents, many Indians, which is the kind of changing levels of tolerance and openness in the society. And I'm referring to various things that are individually kind of unconnected but form a larger whole, whether it's the pub incident in Mangalore that got a lot of attention, where a girl was attacked for essentially drinking in a pub by people who felt women should not drink in pubs, to the fact that India's leading painter, M.F. Hussain, can no longer live in India. And has to live in exile in Dubai because various groups don't like his paintings. Whether it's Raj Thackeray, who's a state politician in Maharashtra and focused in Mumbai, who's riled against migrants to the city, who are the kind of the economic lifeblood of Mumbai, and had many of them leave and threatened violence against them. And the fact that in Bombay today you have vegetarian buildings as a very common kind of building, which is essentially a very covert way to have non-Muslim buildings in areas like Malabar Hill and the like. Many people who grew up in the 60s and 70s remember India as a substantially more tolerant country in some of these respects than it is now. Do you share that concern? Is there an explanation for it?
Yeah, I don't share it because I feel that India is really an ocean. And these incidents which get highlighted today are really absolutely ephemeral, minuscule. They are deplorable. They are condemnable. They have nothing to do with religion. They have nothing to do with tradition. This is just some fringe group, fringe individual, doing it either to establish, oh, I am a big fellow, I am the local dada, yeah, or it is for somebody trying to get votes, and I am sure he will not get many votes on this ground. In Mangalore, this gentleman who is supposed to some Hindu Senani, something or the other, he set up, where is this Senani? Nobody heard of him. And it is a very surprising thing. I mean, it is worse than criminal to beat up a young girl because she goes to a pub. Supposing you are very outraged and you are paragon of virtue on your own, you want to persuade her not to do anything, not to smoke a cigarette, well, please persuade her. I would not even take that responsibility on myself to persuade anybody about his personal life. But to beat up? But the interesting thing is, how is it that when the person was to beat up, all the television crews were in position? It is obviously done by arrangement. Now, if you go to the local BJP fellows, they say, no, this is a Congress ploy who arranged the TV crews, who have been, patronizing this character. He put up 89 candidates against the BJP or something. I don't even want to enter that argument. But it was obviously well staged. Similarly, on Mr. Hussain, he is certainly a very fine painter, and there is no justification whatsoever to... he's an elderly person also. He's a very a wonderfully modest and humble person in spite of the enormous success which he has achieved. There is absolutely no ground whatsoever to berate him, to push him, to do anything to any painting of his or to a gallery which exhibits his painting.
He should be back in India?
Of course he must be. If the Slima Nasreen must be, of course Mr. Hussain must be. But the point is, on the paintings themselves, I personally feel that there's a very interesting thing, and I've written about this also. How is it that Hussain, with his great skill, has never felt that inner inspiration to paint the face of the Prophet in the most glowing and beautiful way? But on Saraswati or others, he does not have any hesitation to portray them as they are portrayed maybe in some of our sculptures, they say, without clothes. Why? Now, of course, you can say, no, that's because they are in the sculptures, they are like this, and there is no representation of the Prophet's face, but no inner inspiration.
There's a double standard.
Yeah, well, double standard in the persons who make that an issue, my friend, on both sides. But I have seen a painting of his, just to give you one instance, please, I have great respect for him. I am on the point of the way we look at these things and make them issues, both the critics and the others. I've seen a painting of his in which on Hanuman's tail, Sita is sitting. She's quite enjoying the experience of rubbing herself on the tail. You can see it. Nothing like that about any of the Prophet's wives. What is that? But this is no reason whatsoever to belabor him, to belabor a gallery or anything of the kind. But this is a reason on which the so-called chaps who start making an issue of this and saying, oh, this is an example of intolerance, they should reflect on it. The third example that you gave on vegetarian buildings, I don't know, but I mean, there are non-smoking buildings. I don't know if this is an overt way to exclude whites or East Europeans who smoke. Why do you think that it is a way to exclude Muslims? We read into
it. Food and religion correlate more in India than smoking and race do.
Well, I don't know.
There are very few vegetarian Muslims.
Kashmiri pundits, every Kashmiri household will have meat.
But very few
Muslims. On the other side, you will insist that no, the Hindus ate beef. That does not correlate with religion. So I would think that the answer to that would be large number of more buildings, so that the occasion the occasion in which I can enforce an exclusionary rule will become less, because there are so many alternate ways to which any tenant can go. Fourth example you gave was on Raj Thackeray. I think there is absolutely no doubt that he is doing it only for the sake of votes.
He's wrong.
Of course. How can there be any doubt on that?
Okay, I want to ask you one more thing myself before we open it up, so start getting your questions ready. I want to ask you about Narendra Modi. To those of you who don't haven't had the pleasure of his acquaintance, he's a very important politician in the same party that Mr. Shuri belongs to. The chief minister, essentially the governor of Gujarat state in the west, which is one of India's richest, biggest, most industrialized states. Those who love him say he's the most pro-development, economically vibrant politician in the country. He makes the trains run on time and the cell phone towers, more importantly, function everywhere, and the highways and all of that. Those who loathe him, and they are in equal numbers, see him as the figurehead of an intolerant BJP politics, particularly for his role in the 2002 riots in that state, where, depending on who you ask, he sat aside and watched as violent riots killed mostly Muslims, but people of both religions, or actively condoned it, depending on who you ask. Ask a very simple question. Should he be, he's been projected by many in your party as a future prime minister, or at least someone who the party should look to as a model. Should he be a future prime minister? Should he be a future model? Or should that simply be off the table in order to build the kind of winning party that you talked about?
It is a question that requires an extended answer. We should not underrate his development work by saying it is running the trains on time. Then you are saying subliminally that he's Mussolini. The fact of the matter is that he has...
it's just the trains in India are so delayed.
That's right. And then you will also say that if he claimed to run the same trains on time, you would say, no, but running the trains is a central responsibility. So how is he claiming credit? His work on development is exemplary. And when he brings water to Kutch or Saurashtra from the Narmada, it is not that water is going only to Hindu fields and not to Muslim fields. That development of highways, of 24-hour electricity to every village in Gujarat does not exclude Muslims or Hindus or anybody.
better health facilities, better education facilities. That is not exclusively for Hindus or for Muslims or for anybody. Why don't we see that also? Second point there is that actually speaking, his critics have made him a national figure today. I personally saw this. You know, one day I was traveling from Delhi to a place deep in the south, in South Kannada district called Manipal, which we have one of our big institutions for medical learning. I had to give lectures there. And it just so happened by coincidence that that is the day on which the last assembly election results for Gujarat were coming out. And actually, because I make it a principle just to get onto the plane and immediately start working, so that I can use those 2 hours productively, I had started working. It was out of my mind. In the middle of the flight, there was the air hostess came, said, "The captain sends you a message that the Modi is doing very well in Gujarat." Thank you. I got down. My next flight was 2 hours after that. The porter who met me, I always carry my own bags, but somebody always meets, "Sir, can we carry your bag?" "Sir, congratulations, sir, congratulations." "What? Sir, he's going, he already crossed 90, sir." That is the porter. Now, then I was taken to a lounge in the Bombay airport where you wait for the next flight. That was 2 hours, 1.5 hours later. And persons come there. "Sir, congratulations. Sir, he's going to cross it. Exceed the last time." These are ordinary people serving tea. In Hindi, they were telling me this. Got onto the flight. I landed. Now, the airport for Mangalore is quite far from this place. And it's a small little shed of an airport. The person taking bags off the that rubber belt there, conveyor belt, he embraced me. "Sir, he's crossed 121. This is from Delhi, the captain, to the porter, to the persons in the serving tea in the room, to the porter in this small airport in deep south. So please realize the great service that the critics are doing to Narendra Modi. He always says this, that I'm grateful to the media.
But I just, before we open it up, do you think should he be the future of the party you want to belong to?
Well, I will tell you, you said that can it be the future of the winning party and so on. He's a strong person, so he may have no use for me. But he will immediately electrify the party if he came to Delhi, as he might well do. And immediately there will be great divisions in the country, which he will then have to overcome. But there is no doubt that if he came to Delhi, the party would be immediately electrified.
Would you bring him to Delhi if it was in your power?
It's not in my power.
If it was?
Let's say to the journalist, you're asking a hypothetical question. Actually, I am blamed for the fact that during...
But you're a journalist too.
No, because in the election campaign, I said that yes, he could be... that I was addressing a press conference in Gujarat. They said, "Tell us some advantages, not for the country, but for Gujarat as to what from this election that can come about." And I had said 2-3 things. And one of them was that you can elect not only the Prime Minister for this time. Mr. Advani was a candidate from a place near Ahmedabad, suburb of Ahmedabad. But also, you can elect the next Prime Minister from here. And they started saying Arun Shuri wants Narendra Modi to be the next Prime Minister. He could well be. And please remember that if this type of propaganda goes on against him and the state continues to go the way it is going of catering to individual sections, then a reaction may well have set in that he would be elected to high office only for that reason. We should not underestimate that.
Well, great to go to open to questions. I reserve the right to keep asking stuff potentially, but let's go to questions. And again, you can ask questions about the subjects we've talked about, which have kind of focused on one area, but we also have an authority here on anything else you might want to know about the new India or how to think about change in India today. So it doesn't have to only cover what we've talked about. Why don't you start, Charlie?
So my name is Charlie.
Sorry,
right?
And just Kennedy School ground rules, as always.
Sure.
Name, affiliation,
yeah.
Short question with a question mark at the end.
So my name is Anshyam Tiwari. I am doing a combined degree with Kellogg School of Management in MBA and Master's in Public Administration at Kennedy School. And we have a very vibrant Indian community here, and we would like to extend you a warm welcome. We did not know about your visit, and a lot of students are right now involved in a visit of Dr. Shankar Menon, who's also here, and I attended a class. So I wanted to use the opportunity first to just welcome you on behalf and also extend a welcome if you want to, I don't know what your plans are, but if you want to hang out with Kennedy School students, you're more than welcome after this event. I'll leave the rest for the question and I'll come back to question later.
You in the back.
Dr. Shuri, my name is Akanksha Pandey and I'm a PhD student at the Graduate School of Arts and Sciences and I am from India. You have talked a lot about this politics and achievement of certain communities and how you stand against that, but it's more secular to support. But the economic policies of the BJP has been argued one reason they lost the election was because they catered only to India shining and not to the rest of Bharat. What I would be interested in your thoughts on what the BJP's future economic policy should be, which you said yourself require more thought, and where do you think the party should go in terms of appealing to the country as a whole, which is largely Bharat and a small part is India?
Just Bharat is the Hindi word for India. So in India, when people talk about India and Bharat, they're referring to the haves and have-nots, those left behind and those not.
Madam, you see, it's very interesting. Mr. Yashwant Sinha has given a very good answer to this. When we say, as you just said, that the BJP's economic policies cater to what you is shining India and not to the masses, that is why it lost the election. Just examine that proposition. How is it that in Punjab those economic reforms got it great kudos? And in Haryana, we were wiped out. The same economic reforms. That in Maharashtra, we lost because of the economic reforms. But in Gujarat, we won. That we lost in Andhra Pradesh, we were wiped out nowhere. But in neighboring Karnataka, we won. That in Rajasthan, Madhya Pradesh, Chhattisgarh, BJP won because of economic reforms. And in all the adjacent states, it lost. How? Because you are just repeating a standard cliche of newspapers. And nobody thought of this explanation till before the elections. You know, I always feel that the time to read election forecasts is after the election. Then you know how much truth there was to the explanation. Everybody in India at 4:15 knows why the stock market has gone up or down. In the morning, they did not know. Oil prices like this, oil prices, the US economic figures have come, Japan, something has happened. And suddenly we have an explanation for Indian stock market behavior, similarly for elections.
But
so between the voting, in India now, between the voting and the election results, there are 6 weeks. What about the explanations at that time? After all, it should have been evident at that time that economic policies were resulting in one result or the other.
But
I just want to... there is a very fine couplet. That why did you order me from the garden of paradise in heaven to come down to earth? But now the ways of the earth are long and dreary. Please wait for me. So also in answering questions. You see, I feel that that liberalization, after it is socialism which was keeping the people, those so-called masses in Bharat and all down. It was accepted by everybody. It's not a BJP invention. The same person who has won the election this time has won it as the father of economic reforms, Manmohan Singh. He's not catering to shining or non-shining? How do we swallow and then put out these explanations? I felt that the election result at that time was because, primarily, because of the weakness of the BJP as an organization in individual states. That was the principal explanation. And the results were an aggregation, as Mr. Advani rightly said, of many local results. You just see, would the economic policies have been vindicated if two political decisions had not been made, which had nothing to do with economic policy? For reasons known only to the central leaders and not known to me, suddenly the BJP leadership decided not to continue the alliance with Mr. Karunanidhi in
Tamil Nadu.
If that decision had not been taken place, 30 seats would have come this side and not gone that side. Similarly, the loss of Mr. Chandrababu Naidu in Andhra, the wiping out, had nothing to do with economic reforms. But as he personally told me at that very time, that he had not realized what had happened to his organization, political party organization, at the local level. That accounted for his being wiped out. Similarly, Mr. Chauthala's loss had to do with the malgovernance of his associates and the reputation they had acquired. It had nothing to do with economic reforms in neighboring Delhi. So I don't think that that is the case, that economic reforms and so on cater to one class rather than the other. When I abolished licensing in telecom, you think it only helped the richer classes? Today everybody says mobile has become the common man's instrument of communication, and that we have the cheapest rates in the world at 1 cent a call. That is helping whom? Ambani? It's helping everybody. Helping them also. Those who are entrepreneurs. Or take privatization. It was said, no, this is only those people who can bid. But the fact of the matter was that because there was great productive potential in those enterprises, which was not being fully exploited, for the benefit of the country, who was suffering? Who was suffering from the fact that the resources could not be used for social programs because they were just swallowed up by loss-making public sector enterprises? The rich or the poor who would have benefited from those social programs? So the explanations were different, and I would personally feel that for the BJP, as for the Congress, as for any other party, studying these issues of reforms in depth and being the great lobby for excellence, reform, for India being an economic power,
the good governance agenda.
Good government agenda will be the way to success, and in any case, the way to the service of the country.
Another question?
So Anirudh Suri, also a student at McKinney School. I think as I look at the various problems that India faces, one of the biggest problems I've seen growing up in India is the problem of implementation. We have great ideas, both at the center, at the state level, at the district level. The problem is of implementation. So I would love to hear your thoughts on how are we going to reform the way all these major state-led initiatives, the rural employment to the free food, how are these going to be implemented so that they have the right impact? And I want to couch this in a larger issue that I think India is facing, which is this constitutional issue of the state-center relationship. Right? The center, as you also suggesting now, seems to be not as powerful as it used to be. Right? You mentioned the loss, you attribute the loss to basically the decisions and the policies of the state leaders. Are we moving to a sort of country where the center is going to become even less powerful, both in terms of implementation, in terms of policy and everything?
So I think that is the central question of implementation. And in India, I just completely agree with what you said. And there are many ways in which this should be, this can be overcome. One of the ways is to incentivize those state governments which will help you implement the programs more swiftly or will do it more efficiently.
Can you also elaborate on the cause as you see it?
Cause. So the cause is no mystery to the cause. It is the governmental, the character of governmental machinery as a whole. If you look at the Planning Commission, I've documented this in several books as to what actually happens in the government departments. Any place, this, the society of India is much healthier than the state. So any functions which are devolved to society will get much better done, and we should work for a lean and more efficient state. That is the theme of reforms from the beginning till now. Second thing is that as far as you were saying of the ways, I'll give you one illustration. That is, incentivize the state governments, because very often the implementation is delayed because of land acquisition, water connection, electricity doesn't come, and that whole set of circumstances. Now, devolution of central funds to the states occurs under two formulae. One is called Gadgil formula and modified slightly by Mr. Pranab Mukherjee many, many years ago, 20, 30 years ago. And that is all related to backwardness. The more backward you are on this principle of equality, the more funds you get. But that means you should actually relate it to the difference that the government has made between that position and the next improvement. So I have been pleading in Parliament that you have a fund of 100,000 crores. Give it to those state governments which help or which themselves implement projects more swiftly. Well, you know, yes and no. After all, we have a thing called the Accelerated Irrigation Works Program. We have the Accelerated Power Projects Program. Incentivize that. Nobody has said it is terrible. You can have objective criteria for that. Everything is politically difficult in a quagmire. And then we should not do anything, because this is the way things are. Similarly, another cause for delays in implementation is the long... Anybody can stop it by going to the courts and getting a stay order. The Narmada project was delayed by about 17 years.
A major dam building project.
A dam building project, yes. So we should have a great dialogue with the judiciary on the economic costs of their interventions, of their procedures, and of their delays. In one of my books, I've calculated the cost just in terms of interest in the amounts that had already been spent on this Narmada Dam. Between the conclusion of the hearings and the giving of the judgment in that case, it came to a few thousand crores. So a dialogue with the courts to show them that time is a factor of production. You want to decide, you want to intervene, please do so immediately.
So we have an incentive system for states that do well, and a conversation with courts about
and
delay.
And third is, responsibility to be fixed on individual officers because of whom things have got delayed. This just doesn't happen.
Again, performance culture.
Performance, yes.
Let's go to more questions. You want to ask your question now?
So finally, my question. We had a great discussion on Gandhi the past week within the Indian community, and how he was the leader who integrated the various factions in society. He stood for a national vision towards caste and religion in several ways. And we also talked about how there's a vacuum right now, that no leader has been able to capture the imagination of masses and gain the love of masses to stand for that integrated India. Now, you reasoned successfully through great examples of how social exclusion doesn't happen because of caste or religion. But I also come from a village where, in Bihar, where caste is a primary factor. And I also have friends who are Muslims who talk about exclusion. how does the leadership of BJP, how is it going to reconcile these different aspects?
So I don't know about the leadership of BJP, but I have only one formula, and that is you deliver. If you deliver good services, if public service delivery in a state is good, then the discharge will go automatically. Abundant and good.
Isn't that utopian? It will take an amount of time to reach there.
My friend, it is not, I mean, to just to go back to the example of Gujarat, it has not taken 5 years. But the Bihar politics has been of caste, and therefore there is no delivery and only caste. It's not utopian. You can think, I have worked with the same bureaucracy. And you could make it work. The same bureaucracy will deliver. After all, how has crime gone down in Bihar now? How?
You're talking about two examples in 60 years in some way.
Well, not two examples. But in any place, in Punjab, at the time of Sardar Pratap Singh Khairo, we were the exemplars of development. How? And the same civil service is not able to deliver today. So the root of the problem is the kind of person who's coming into public office through electoral politics. That's why I have been pleading for constitutional changes in the way that we are run. We are constituted.
Thank you.
Over here on the right.
My name is Bikul Bhatia. I come from the World Bank, been working in the energy sector. I have some interest in the education sector as well, and doing a master's here. My question actually pertains to development of human capital. We have a 40-year demographic window, after which the demographic liability sets in. Now, we seem to be unprepared in terms of human capital development to really take on this window and emerge as a developed country. What do you think is the solution which can cause education to be spread to the masses over a very short period of time, say within a decade or so, just so that we have our people ready to encash this opportunity in time?
Great question.
Actually, yes. It's not only to the masses, but also to we need higher technical education as much. It's not one or the other.
It's
and
both.
Both, we have the resources for both. Now, and I feel that one of the, this can take a long answer, but I'll give you one point. That is, that if you want very rapid, for instance, literacy programs in India, then use technology for that purpose. And I'll give you one example from the minute that can begin. See, the father of information technology in India is a person called Mr. F.C. Kohli, who founded the Tata Consultancy Services. He has done work in Andhra. That work is to children like mine, our child is a multiply handicapped child. So how do you teach such children? By total immersion method. That is, that he sees a picture, umbrella. He hears the word umbrella. He sees the function of the umbrella to ward off the sun, to ward off the rain, to ward off somebody. Why? Because the adult knows the word. But how do we teach him literacy? By letters. So Kohli did a study of the main paper there in Inadu. 90% of the circulation is one paper called Inadu, which is a very literary paper in a sense. That a knowledge of 700 Telugu words will enable a person to read the paper fluently. So he said, why teach illiterate ladies who already know the vocabulary and the language by letters? Why not teach them the picture of the word as a hieroglyph? So the word comes umbrella. She knows an umbrella, but she sees the picture of the word written. It's like a picture. There's an umbrella drawn also. The function is is in a picture. So through computers, at persons coming at their own convenience for 1 to 1.5 hours a day. I don't know the latest figure, but last time I met at least some millions of, 2-3 million people had been educated within 6 weeks to read the Inadu. So such uses. Similarly, for technology, we have a great shortage of teachers. You can use technology so that Anand gives, he's the best teacher on a particular subject. He gives the lecture, it is broadcast all over the state or it is stored and anybody can access it, and the local teacher does only the tutorial work. So solutions of this kind can deliver that literacy within 10 years. I have no doubt on that at all.
Before we move on, just a quick thing on that. It's always struck me that because of the scale problem, India really could be one of the first countries that has to look at whether education needs to be without teachers in a substantial, to a substantial degree at least. Is that something that needs to be contemplated?
Yes, I think maybe without universities. In one of the papers that Devesh Kapoor and Pratap Bhanu Mehta have done recently, they said, "This is let's have a thought experiment.
Yeah.
Do away with universities. A student can study and get information any way he wants to, by attending classes, by not attending,
cell
by
phones.
Cell phone, anyway, and you just have universal, well-administered exams for any post or any entry that you require for the next round. So teachers, you can't necessarily do without the teacher, but it's a way of dramatizing the fact that use technology to get the best teacher to deliver the lecture, but follow-up work can be
right.
done by the local teacher.
But changing the model fundamentally.
Changing the model, yes. And actually, I'm doing a paper.
So could I just pass this paper to you?
Please, yes. I'd love to.
More questions. In the back.
Yes, my name is Dinyar. I'm a PhD candidate in Indian history here. Pursuing history, what are your views on Jinnah? And why has Jinnah been such a particularly big stumbling block for the BJP?
So my views on Jinnah are different from the views of my very dear friend and senior colleague, Mr. Jaswant Singh, I regard, because the fact that he was in his personal life very secular and so on is neither here nor there. Just as for Anand...
Sorry, Jinnah being the founder of Muhammad Ali Jinnah, the founder of Pakistan.
Just as for... till 1935, Jinnah's politics was quite... ordinary, and then because of the great defeat of the Muslim League, actually he left India and went that I now not have anything to do with the politics, and then the Muslim League leaders get him back, and then his rhetoric and his entire thesis are murderously communal. And he said that I have forged a pistol, which was these violent Muslim gangs which started the killings in Kohat in other places, which unnerved the Congress and brought it to a situation in which they were more amenable to the idea of partition. So I don't have a very... a person who does it without even the faith of Maulana Maududi in Islam is then a hypocrite. And then, I don't have a great, very high opinion for him, for which I have been soundly scolded by persons, for instance, like Mr. H.M. Sirvai, who said, no, but you didn't see him practice at the Bombay Bar. I saw him, and so on. And he was so wonderful a person. Probably true. But
then why has Jinnah been such a polarizing figure, though?
No, I think that actually, that is, for instance, Jinnah has become a factor only on two occasions. One was not a polarizing factor. One was Mr. Advani gave a statement or a part of a speech in which he quoted a speech, one of the 4 or 5 speeches that Jinnah made, that after, now that we are independent, this is a speech to the inauguration of the Constituent Assembly of Pakistan, now that we are independent, Pakistan will not have any distinction between one religion or the other, etc. And he said that this would be the model that Pakistan, India, Bangladesh should all follow. That was his way, he says, of needling Pakistan to stick to a secular ideal rather than to what it has followed. The attack on Mr. Advani on that had more to... That was the occasion, not the cause, for the attack. Secondly, on Mr. Jaswant Singh, absolutely nobody had read his book before they took a decision to expel him. There's no doubt nobody can read 600 pages with any thoroughness in 1.5 hours, which is what happened. The book was released, and within 1.5 hours, a party had given it a verdict, a statement, and everybody thought that this is over, the matter is over. But then, for other reasons, I feel that the party then moved to expel him, and I opposed that. And I wrote in favor, against the ban that Mr. Narendra Modi had imposed on the book, wrote strongly against it, showed how it was wrong in law, and am delighted that the Gujarat High Court then struck down the ban. But Jinnah just became the occasion for other reasons. Jaswant Singh had taken up the issue of reform in the party. That was the reason.
My name is Jason Zhao. I'm with the South Asian Men's Collective from Harvard College. And I want to ask you about private enterprise. You mentioned earlier that it's one of the key paths to development in India. I'm particularly curious about what you think the BJP as a party can do in terms of policy to distinguish itself and facilitate the development of private enterprise in India, and what members of the diaspora, if anything, besides foreign direct investment, what we can do to participate in the development.
So as far as the BJP, in India there is great entrepreneurship. It is evident in every way, even during the last 2-3 years. You know, I traveled, as I'm sure Anandan all traveled much more, but I had occasion to travel to the US, to Europe, to Japan, to Southeast Asia in the last 2 years after this meltdown, 1.5 years. And I never saw in India the kind of doom and gloom talk that we heard in all these other countries. Our entrepreneur said, yes, there's a difficulty, but sir, don't worry, we'll come out of it. In 1 year, we'll be out of it. That is really true. That is the resilience. In fact, the entrepreneurs and the middle class in India are the two classes that are making the new India. So I feel that as far as the BJP is concerned, the best thing it can do is to clarify its own mind on these matters in the central leadership, and at the state level, execute, implement the projects which you sanction for private entrepreneurs. That's the way to help them and to refurbish the image of the political party. As far as the diaspora is concerned, firstly, to do well in your own professions. We should not underestimate that, because it is the Indian who was in the US as a professional who changed the world's perception about India and thereby helped change India's perception of itself, that Indians can do it. So doing well wherever you are is a great contribution to India. Second, I think, is it's very necessary, because in India we are so preoccupied with our current problems, and so satisfied in being preoccupied with our current problems, that it is necessary to always beam the world to India. So that, you know, people realize what's happening elsewhere in the world, in China, in Southeast Asia, the contest in Central Asia. We must beam it to India through columns, through talking to our relatives, through every possible way, through the internet, so as to lift Indians out of their immediate concerns. And third, I think, is all of us should help turn India's sights to the future, about new technologies which have already been developing, about new trends and what implications they will have for India, about the strategic environment changes and what implications it will have, about the revolution in military affairs in China and what implications it will have. Turn India to the future. It's very necessary.
You've been very persistent raising your hand, so just a short question,
and then we have people. My name is Karan Reddy Pendry. I'm a student at Harvard College. I appreciate your answer that, you know, it's the deterioration of the organization as opposed to some response to economic policies or something that might have led to the BJP's electoral failures. And all politics is definitely local. But for those of us who have seen local electoral machinery in India, it seems that the funding of the political parties is one of the most perverse aspects of what goes on in that country and its democracy. How do we solve this problem? How do we turn the funding of political parties into a more transparent or acceptable format?
I have no particular solution to that. I am certainly, I don't think that the financing by the state is any panacea. They will, Indian political parties will take money from the states, state exchequer, and also get money elsewhere. So then you have to have very strict rules about other things. For instance, the number of political meetings, the number of posters that can be put up, all those things then have to be regulated, and the Indian state is not capable at this time to take on that huge regulatory task that no other money will be spent at all. That will not be possible. So I don't have an immediate solution to that at all. I've been advocating one small thing, that is that the persons who finance political parties are in a stronger position to bring about political reform than any leader of any political party. So they must take a greater interest in the character of the parties and the character of the persons whom they finance. Supposing they were a shareholders' movement instigated by the managements themselves, that yes, we know our management will give money to political parties, but if it turns out that it has given money to a political party that has fielded even one candidate with a criminal background, our directors will lose their jobs as such.
Do you think India's more or
just
less?
Just one second. I think that would be a better way of bringing about the decriminalization of politics than any type of law that we may pass. And they can say that, look here, our hands are tied. We want to give you the money, but you see, don't give the ticket to so-and-so. Give it to anybody else. So such things would be better for cleaning, but that does not solve the problem of financing. Sorry.
It's just a short question before we wrap up. Do you think India is more or less corrupt than when you were an investigative journalist?
I think the scale of corruption is much, much, much larger. It is unimaginable. I've had to say this in Parliament. Of what I hear from the industrialists who have had to pay money, of the open talk on things which I myself had cleaned up in government, of the type of monies that is changing hands for decisions, the scale is just unimaginable.
Well, we've heard everything from the need for organizational reform to...
If I may just have one very short question which probably would interest everyone.
Okay.
It's just one. How does one join a political party in India without necessarily seeking a ticket? Political parties have think tanks. If I wanted to join the BJP today, what do I have to do? Because I don't want to join my Mohalla level engagement, given my skills and whatever I bring to the table. How do I pitch in?
I think get to know individuals and wait for the chance. But I would not sacrifice a good professional career for doing that. You can do it on the side. But you see, the one problem for all of us professionals is that we always think of politics in a very narrow way. And that is how to enter a political party for purposes of electoral politics. But why not ask a second question, how to participate in Indian public life, which is much larger than electoral politics and certainly much larger than the lives of these political parties and gangs? That's very important. We can participate in public life, take up one issue, become the great specialist on that. Linking of interwater, rivers, education. And on that, focus on changing Indian perceptions and policies on that particular sphere. We would have entered public life. And we would be seen as effective on that point. Much better than trying to get into a political party and then to see how to get in the favor of Anand than anybody else. Not necessary. for that, a good chance.
Well, we've heard about, as I was saying, organizational reform. We've heard that a party of principle should follow its principles regardless of whose votes it gets or doesn't get as a result. We've heard about a definition of secularism. We've heard of some ambivalence on Narendra Modi. We've heard about changing the model in education and rethinking everything. And we've heard that implementation is the central challenge that India faces. You've been remarkably open and candid and said some things that may not get you in trouble and some things that may, but it's been very entertaining. And thank you very much for spending the time to talk to us.